Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
We chased the number one seed. We lost two games to Atlanta that, you know, we should have won. It's going to be a tough road, whether you're first seed, second seed, or third seed. You know, the Eastern Conference has gotten better.
The most gratifying thing for me is just, you know, we completed the season healthy. That we was able to come out of this long season with a lot of injuries, and we played through it, and our guys got through it, and now the playoffs are here, and we have all 15 guys healthy. So that's the most important thing to me and to this organization, to our team. With that being said, I feel very confident and comfortable that we got a good run in us.
My confidence is that we can win. I know we can win the series. We just got to play Cavaliers basketball, which we're capable of doing, which we show we can do. So I know we have confidence to win, and we are going to win. So
they've been playing well. You know, with Paul George, you know, coming off pin downs and trying to run LeBron around off catching shoots. We've got to be prepared for that. Also, with Teague being, you know, a fast guard who can get downhill and put a lot of pressure on you and get into the paint. Those are two things that, you know, we got to be better at. We got to be good at going into the playoffs.
I think there should be some concern there. They obviously didn't close out the season as they should have. We talked a little bit about the maturity of a championship team, the level that you need to be at. They aren't there. And they showed some weaknesses throughout the end of the season. However, it's the playoffs. They have the best player in the league in LeBron James. They got time to get it back going. I mean, they'll have a tough first-round series against Indiana. This team is not going away easy.
I'd be lying if I didn't say there's reason for concern. Sure. I mean, we had a very rocky, adverse regular season. In many ways, that's a real blessing for us because it's how we like it. This team is much more comfortable with its back against the wall and when everybody says we can't.
Well, that was our season, wasn't it? I mean, always down early. Our starters never get us, or very rarely get us off to a good start. Come back, which we do most of the time. Bad shooting team. And you pretty much in one game saw us for what we were this year.
This part of the season, it's always been that way. I mean, you look at the good teams, with, you said, the big three resting and some of these other really good teams. Of course they're rested. They don't care about being in that second spot. They care about being healthy. And now you talk about some of these bad teams that are resting. That's nothing that's changed either. I mean, you talk about with the Nets, they know what Jeremy Lin can give them. They know what they know what their good players can give them. You got guys that have been practicing all season long, looking for an opportunity to play. Well, here's their chance to play.
Ground ball, base hit left field. One run scores. And they're going to stop Victor at third. It's an RBI single for Tyler Collins. Here's the 1-2. Driven deep to right field. Trap, wall, grand slam. Andrew Romine.
I see you, Andrew. Unbelievable.
I see you. What a start to the year for Romine. And he popped him up. Shallow center field, Romine, and the Tigers win.
Carlos really cooled off. Edwin hasn't gotten going yet. That's our leadoff or our cleanup hitter. Jose's not had a ton of hits. That'll change. You know, everybody wants it to change yesterday, you know, myself included, but you got to be patient. It'll change.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I tell you what, Eazy-E, Edwin Encarnacion, it damn well better change. You're killing me, man. Your $60 million bat is whiffing and swinging and GIDPing and everything but getting hits and scoring runs. Not only are you killing my Indians, you're killing my fantasy on Daily FanDuel Fantasy Baseball. Come on, E! What's going on? Welcome to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, 11 minutes after 3. We appreciate you being with us for the next 2 hours. We are Toledo's sports leader. A lot of stuff to get into. Good stuff in the montage there. Getting ready for the NBA playoffs to begin on Saturday. The Cavaliers have drawn the Pacers in the 2-7 matchup. Talk about that matchup, and we'll talk more importantly about how far will the Cavaliers go. Heard a little bit in that montage from Stan Van Gundy. We know how far the Pistons are going to go. Home. That's how far they're going. They're done. Season's over. That's the end of that. A little bit more about resting players and kind of a controversy last night with the Nets resting virtually everybody for whatever reason. We're going to look at some of our younger players. You've been out of it since November. Why don't you play your younger players all year long and get a look at them then? Why are you trying now to mess with eighth seed of the NBA playoffs. Talking about the Nets Bulls game, of course, last night. So we'll get into that a little bit. And obviously you heard a little bit of the baseball highlights as well. Tigers are a rolling to start the season. Indians are just kind of humming along. They're 4-4, winning some, losing some in the early going. Terry Francona waiting for Edwin Encarnacion to get his bat working. And not just him, by the way. What did they have yesterday, Cushlin? How many hits? 3 hits? That's all we got? 3 god-blank hits? You know what I was doing there, right?
Yeah, of course. Okay, just don't worry. Nobody's listening anyway.
You can't say that on the radio. Don't worry. Nobody's listening anyhow. But that's kind of how I felt when I saw that box score yesterday. 3 hits, 3 GD hits is how I felt about it.
Yep.
2 of them to Frankie Lindor, by the way. My gosh. If there's an MVP for the first 8 games of the season, it's Lindor. In baseball, not just for the Indians. It's got to be Lindor. He's got 4 home runs, continues to rake, just not enough support.
Yep.
Nice, decent outing yesterday for Danny Salazar, by the way.
And that was nice to see, I think, you know, a decent outing, for Salazar. The opposite of a decent outing, though, would be, in the final afternoon game, Tigers go on the road to Cleveland, by the by, tomorrow, so they'll actually play their first evening game in action, trying to get the, sweep, and it's not going well because Jordan Zimmermann did not have it, couldn't get out of the 5th, 9 total base runners, 5 coming across to score. It's 6-2 Twins, right now in the 6th.
Top 6, right?
Yeah, top 6 for that one. So we had one good outing on the one hand, and a good outing yesterday by Fulmer, but then not a good outing for Jordan Zimmermann. They need him to bounce back.
Yeah, they do.
All the talk of the Tigers trying to stay with the Indians, you know, in theory in our preseason prognostications, I think part of that is based on we got to have Jordan Zimmermann be healthy and him doing what he's capable of doing behind Verlander. You need that.
Hey, you know, we talked a couple of days ago about the very slow start that Miguel Cabrera had gotten off to, and it was, you know, it was bad. We knew, of course, it's going to come around, and he had a home run.
Yes, he did.
Today. Here's an interesting stat from the ESPN Stats and Information Department. His home run today was his 54th Oppo home run since the start of 2011.
Okay.
2011 seasons. So that's what? That's 6 seasons, 7, yes, 7 seasons, 7 starts to the season counting this year. That's the most in the major leagues in that span. 54 opposite field home runs since the start of the 2011 season. Who do you think is second? Think about all the home run hitters and think about guys like Miggy who have the ability to, you know, in the bat control and the power to all fields kind of, you know, talent that he has, where he can take an outside pitch the other way. He can drive the ball the other way with ease. There's not a ton of guys like that, obviously. Any clue? I'll give you 3 guesses as to who's second.
Oh, geez.
And I bet you're not going to get it.
Okay. Oh, man. I don't even know where to start.
He's in this state.
He's in this state.
Yes.
So we're in Ohio.
Yes.
Joey Votto.
That's a good guess.
Look at Frank Gargano getting it on the first try. My goodness. How did you pull that one out of your hat?
You know what it is, Bob?
Dude is en fuego.
I'm going to go. I got a theory on this one. He being a Cubs fan, you and I are Indians fans, he pays a little more attention to the National League. Honest to goodness, I've done that ever since I was a kid. I look at the National League second. You know,
you're right. I do too. For the most part.
That answer. I'm sitting here scanning through the Indians lineup. I haven't even gotten to the Reds yet.
Wow.
Killer Joey Votto.
And that's why I said he's in this state. How'd you know that so easily, Frank?
It honestly was the first name that popped into my head. As soon as you said in this state, I was thinking, no, it can't be an Indian, because if it was an Indian, Cushlin would know it right off the top of his head. So it had to be a Red, and he's the best player on the Reds.
There you go. Well
done.
Sound
logic right there.
Yeah, Joey Votto. And the reason I was kind of setting it up the way I did is I don't picture Votto as having that kind of opposite field power. He's a big, strong horse of a guy that I just, you know, picture as a dead pole hitter and most of his home runs being pulled, but apparently not. Second most behind Miguel Cabrera. So just a little bit of trivia there. All right. I'm sorry. What was that?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I heard Frank. It's a little echo on that, I guess. Okay, guys. I want to get into a number of different things this afternoon here on the Extravaganza. The NBA's regular season is finally over.
Oh, thank God.
Wasn't it a painful season?
It was.
I thought this was one of the least interesting, I don't know if I want to say exciting. There were exciting moments. Some of the incredible, you know, numbers put up and fantastic finishes and guys like Westbrook and things that have happened, there was a lot of excitement individually, I suppose.
Yeah.
But collectively, as an NBA season, I just thought the season sucked. There was no real drama. There were no fights to the finish for division championships, even though the conference top seeds in the Eastern Conference was up in the air into the final week. It just didn't matter to anybody, I guess. Arguments about guys sitting and resting and whether or not they should rest on the road or at home or rest at all or play fewer minutes. There just wasn't a whole lot of real compelling basketball, I don't think, this season. I think records fell at far too fast of a pace. Devin Booker scored 70 god-blasted points in a single game.
Yeah. Who?
Yeah, Devin Booker did. I mean, because that's what you think of when you think about the highest scoring games in NBA history.
Right.
You think of names like Chamberlain and Jordan and Bryant and Booker and,
Hey, wait, what? One of these things is not like the other.
Yeah, thank you, Sesame Street. Because it's not, you know, and then, did you see this statistic too? As everybody marvels at the fact that Russell Westbrook broke the NBA's single season record for most triple doubles in a season with 42, and he averaged a triple double for the entire season, both of which are incredible statistics. And he was barely better than James Harden in that regard. Only come to find out now that James Harden came within 1 point of an even different kind of a record, but similar. Most points scored or assisted on in a single season in NBA history. That's you scoring or guys scoring off of your passes. The record was set by Nate Tiny Archibald back in 1972-73. He scored or assisted on 4,539 points. James Harden in 2016-17 scored or assisted on 4,538 points. He missed it by one bleeping point. Oh, I wish he would have gotten. I wish he would have scored two more because, I mean, just a different kind of a record, I suppose. Now, while praising Harden, which I'm going to do because I have made up my mind in this ongoing debate between Harden and Westbrook or Harden, Westbrook, and Kawhi or Harden, Westbrook, Kawhi, and LeBron, however you see the four primary names mentioned in the MVP voting or category, or contest. I've made up my mind, and I'll get to Harden in a second. He's my guy. I've gone back and forth on Westbrook through the last month or so, but I've ended up on Harden, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But just to really shine a spotlight on a guy who just doesn't get enough spotlight in NBA history, and I'm talking about Nate Tiny Archibald, he scored or assisted on 4,539 points at a time in which the NBA did not have what?
A three-point line.
That means, and I don't know exactly how many threes Harden hit, but it's a lot. I don't know how many threes that his teammates hit, but they were a lot. He gets an extra point every single time he assists or makes one of those, and he still came up just 1 point shy. That's not to diminish Harden. Like I said, he's going to be my guy. But just to throw a little bit of credit to the old school, just a little bit of a head nod, tip of the cap, whatever you want to say to Tiny Archibald. That brother did that with just the 2-point shots, and that's it. And that means so many more things had to happen for him to do that. He had to score so many more shots and obviously make so many more perfect passes to lead to points. So just a little bit of a tip of the cap to the greats, one of the greats of a bygone era.
One of the 50 greatest, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yeah. Well, was he?
I think.
That's a really good question. I don't know if he was.
How are you going to make me triple check? I could swear he's on that list.
He should have been.
He was on that list. But let me check
for
you.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you're right. And if he didn't, if he wasn't, I should say, then a crime has been committed. Because, again, he's one of those guys that is never going to get his due because he played in an era that is, quite frankly, forgotten about in a lot of ways. They were talking about that a little bit this morning, too, on Mike and Mike. What was it, Mike and Mike? I think it was Mike and Mike. Anyway, about Tiny Archibald and some other players from the 70s who
Here he is, Tiny Archibald. Yep.
Outstanding. Good for him. He deserves it. But nobody talks about him when we talk about the all-time guards. You know? Whenever we see guards doing great things, like Steph Curry won back-to-back MVPs, you know, obviously a few years back, Steve Nash won MVPs, Isaiah Thomas. We start talking about, you know, great all-time guards, particularly the smaller guards. How many times did we have that conversation about, look at Isaiah Thomas now, Isaiah Thomas, the young one from Boston, who's 5'9". Zeke from the Pistons was only 6 feet even.
Right.
You know, what was Stockton was like 6'1". Allen Iverson was 6 foot, maybe. Some say that was a stretch just to give him that six, that he was actually under 6 feet tall. And we talk about all of the great smaller guards of all time. We had a discussion about this, and I don't know the context or exactly. Isn't Chris Paul only 6 foot as well?
I think so.
I think he's listed at 6'0". We talked a while back on the show about great little men. You know, the greatest point guards in NBA history, the greatest small point guards, not the Magic Johnsons or 6'5" Russell Westbrooks and 6'5" James Hardens and all these kind of guys, but just the, you know, the real small. And ironically, a guy with a nickname of Tiny's name is never mentioned when you talk about the great smaller guards, 6 foot or less in NBA history. Because Tiny Archibald, how tiny was Tiny Archibald? He was, I want to say, he was like 5'10", maybe 5'9", 5'8".
Yeah, I know he was not 6 feet, hence the name.
Obviously, yeah. I mean, but I don't think he was as small as like Spud Webb, 5'7".
No, I think Spud Webb still has that crown.
Yeah, well, that's not a
crown. No.
Muggsy Bogues was 5'3".
Yeah.
Muggsy Bogues was, let me say that again, for those who don't know Muggsy Bogues, young listeners right now, young fans, who never saw Muggsy Bogues playing out of Wake Forest, playing with Alonzo Mourning with the Hornets, back in the 90s, I want to say late 90s or mid 90s. I'm trying
to remember
exactly when.
That would have been mid and late before he went to Miami.
Muggsy Bogues was straight up 5'3". Let me say that so you appreciate that for a moment. How many people do you know that are 5'3" or less? I mean, honestly, 5'3" is a really short woman. I once dated a girl who's 5'3", and I'm 6'3", and it was like really weird. You know, my son is 13 years old, and he's 6'1". I mean, 5'3".
Yeah, and I
there
can
are fourth
relate.
Graders that are 5'3".
And
okay?
I can relate to this one, Bob, because I am a very vertically challenged, and by those listings, even I beat out Muggsy Bogues by an inch.
You're 5'4"?
I am 5'4", yes.
Okay, so think about that. Dude not only played, but played well.
Yes.
I won't say he was a star. But for 5'3", you should not be able to defend anybody. And in basketball, quite obviously, if you can't defend anybody, you pretty much don't make it. You don't make it on a roster. That's just the way that it is. You know, you've got to be able to defend somebody. You've got to be able to do something. And even though a guy like Isaiah Thomas can do his thing at 5'9", that's 6 inches taller. 6 inches taller than Tyrone Muggsy Bogues. So Muggsy Bogues played at Wake Forest from 83 to 87. I got him pulled up here now. Played in the NBA from 87 to 2001. Dude had a 14-year career.
Yep.
How can that possibly be? And that's just one of the greatest, one of my favorite players of all time. One of the greatest things I've ever seen. Honest to God. Let's see. He played with the Bullets for the first year, 87-88. Then he went to the Hornets, as I mentioned, played with Alonzo Mourning, 88 to 97. Then he was with the Warriors for a couple of years, 97 to 99, finished it out with the Raptors, 99 to 2001. He was a coach for the Charlotte Sting. I guess that's WNBA, I'm guessing. Or is that D-League stuff? I don't know, Charlotte Sting. From 05 to 07, and United Faith Christian Academy, coached there from 2011 to 2014. Anyway, Cat was 5'3", and I don't want to get too far off into the weeds here. I know it's a little late, but here we are. I just get into topics like this, and I love them. Oh, that's right. He was a teammate of Manute Bol.
Which makes it even more stark.
7'7", and 5'3", standing one another. The tallest and shortest players in NBA history at the time.
Yep.
That's just craziness.
Yeah, that's almost as bad as that one time I got to go to a Cavs season wrap-up kind of thing. You know, they press in the locker room and all that good stuff. And I was literally standing right next to Z. It was Adrudis Nogalskis.
Right.
I came up to just past his waist.
And Muggsy Bogues would be looking up at you.
Barely, but yes.
Think about that for a minute. Just to throw this at you know, and I'll stop the sidetrack here, and I've got sidetracked here. I'm chasing a squirrel. Muggsy Bogues averaged in his career 7.7 points and 7.6 assists. He shot 45% from the floor for his career at 5'3". To give you a little perspective, Russell Westbrook shot the ball at 42% this season. Let me throw more at you just for the sake of it. Do you know that at 5'3", Muggsy Bogues once averaged a double-double?
Really?
In 1993-94, he averaged 10.8 points and 10.7 assists. And oh, by the way, just for the hell of it, he averaged 4.1 rebounds, a career high that year as well. How is a dude 5'3" getting 4 rebounds a night?
What, four? What about one?
Right. You know, he came 0.6 away from another double-double back in 89-90, his second year with Charlotte. He had 9.4 points and 10.7 assists. He had another year of 10 points and 8.8 assists. 8.9 points, 9.1 assists. The dude was just straight-up productive player. At 5'3". I don't know, man. I just love stories like that.
Yep.
I love stories like that. I love recounting them, and I'm doing something probably for the 20-something young fans who might be listening right now, and who have no idea what in the hell we're talking about. But that's why I wanted to share that. Oh, by the way, as far as tiny, because I was trying to figure out how short he actually was not below 6 foot, Jim.
Really?
Believe it or not, wow. Tiny's nickname was more of a nickname than a description. He was 6'1", which
okay.
is, I think, the same as, actually, it's an inch taller. Didn't Isaiah Thomas play at 6'0", or was he also 6'1"?
I mean,
Zeke Thomas, not the Celtics.
Right. I got to double check, but I think that's right. And then you mentioned Chris Paul earlier. Chris Paul is listed as 6 foot even.
6'0", that's what I thought. And Isaiah Thomas of the Pistons, of Bad Boys fame, he was 6'1", same exact thing as Thomas.
Okay.
So there you go. So he wasn't under 6 foot, but obviously all of those guys are technically tiny in the monster skyscraper world of the National Basketball Association. All right, so that's a lot of stuff, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing but memories. And I like those memories, so that's why I do them sometimes. But we're going to talk a little bit about the Westbrook story and the MVP. The Big O himself, Oscar Robertson, endorsed Russell Westbrook. He was there for their last game. He endorsed Russell Westbrook for MVP, in fact, leading the crowd in the chants, which is amazing to me, and that is a great story, and I love the Big O, but he's wrong. Sorry, Big O, he's wrong, and I think he's got some maybe ulterior motive in pushing for this MVP for Russell Westbrook. I will explain, and I will tell you who I think the real MVP should be and why. Also, four outfielders. Kind of an interesting topic of conversation in the national scene right now. Four outfielders coming to the National Basketball Association, Major League Baseball. What are they talking about? Are they talking about adding another defender? No, we're just talking about an extension of the shift for Deadpool hitters. It's an extension of the shift, but not adding another infielder on that side of the infield for the pull hitter. They're talking about adding a full on another outfielder. Some are saying it's an affront to the game. They don't like it at all. I want to see how you feel about that. Should there be such a thing in baseball as an illegal defense? I want to talk a little bit about that. I mentioned the playoffs are set. We're going to talk about the matchups. Cavaliers have the Pacers in the first round. We'll get into that a little bit. It'll be Russell Westbrook and James Harden going head-to-head in the first round in the Western Conference.
Oh, I love that one.
What's that?
I love how that's matched up
together.
Yeah,
that's perfect. That's perfect. It's just too bad that they can't save their MVP votes and cast them at the end of that series.
That was my second thought after I saw that matchup.
Let's just see it. You know what? You sign them up. Let's do this thing.
Because in the minds of a lot of fans, if they were to have a vote, a lot of the fans, part of what we would see in this upcoming series would be part of their vote, but as we know, they don't do that in
any of them. No, but even if it's the writers, which it is, I would just like them to not have their vote until they see them play head-to-head for a seven-game series.
Darn right.
They're going to go at one another. And what's really interesting to me, is they're not probably going to guard one another, because each team has a very, very high-level perimeter defensive guard on their rosters. They're going to try to shut down the other guy. Each team has probably a guy who's going to be on one of the top two first or second team all NBA defensive team lists when that comes out. And so they're not going to guard one another, but they are going to have to go against one another and lead their teams or not to that series victory. And I think that would be very interesting. And lastly, on the NBA, I'm going to talk about this. Do too many NBA teams make the playoffs? As I listened to Greeny and Golic this morning kind of just running down, here's the 1-8 matchup, and here's the 2-7, and here's the 3-6, and here's the 4-5, and I'm just thinking to myself, you know, it's a little much. It's a little too much, to be quite honest with you, especially when you get into what we always talk about when we get into the deserve factor. And what I mean by that is, if you're at under 500, if you're at 500 or under, you should not be playing in the postseason with a chance at a championship. If you lost more than you won, or if you couldn't win more than you lost, even at 541-41, you should not be participating. And that doesn't happen every year, obviously, but there are many years where it does. And to me, I just kind of wonder, are we not really overdoing this? And we know why they're overdoing it. More games, more series, more money, more telecasts, more advertisers, more revenue, more salaries, et cetera, on down the line. So all of that to get into today and much, much more. I want you to be a part of it. Were you a part of fantasy, daily fantasy baseball last night at FanDuel.com? Yeah, I was. Didn't go so well, at least all the way around, because I'm really counting on Edwin Encarnacion to get himself going, and it did not happen yet. He was 0 for 2 last night. And still struggling, has just one home run and one RBI in the season. Anyway, fantasy golf, fantasy baseball, fantasy basketball, it's all available to you at FanDuel.com. It makes playing the or watching the game so much more fun when you're playing against your friends or in big money-making contests. For golf, which is brand new this year, pick your contest, choose your golf team, watch the scores come in live, and win cash prizes. That's right, for birdies and pars and eagles and more. And you know what? There's something for everybody. You could play your first contest at just a dollar. That's right. Contests start at just a dollar. Make sure you submit your lineup before tee off on Thursday, which of course was earlier this morning for this week's event, and you can play all the time. Daily fantasy baseball, though, like I say, you can do that all the time, as well as basketball. I had Max Scherzer last night as well. Max Scherzer, 6 innings, 3 runs, 4 hits, struck out 10, but took the L. So, you know, you get the good with the bad. Also, Chris Davis of Baltimore is 3 for 5, scored a couple, solo home run. Kind of figured he was due for a breakout in the power department, and we were right. When I say we, because Jim Cushlin and Frank Argano and I, we all kind of put our heads together when we put our picks in on fantasy baseball. Anyway, join us, will you? Because you know what? 2.5 million players win cash prizes or have won cash prizes playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. It's so much fun. Join us. If you're a new user, by the way, and you do sign up, you'll get FanDuel's combo 5-pack valued at up to $50. That's 5 free entries. To a combination of 50-50 beginner contests, and you get it free. That's right. Just finish in the top half of the 50-50 contest to win cash. To get those 5 free entries valued at up to $50, go to FanDuel.com and click the Join Now button and type in my last name. It's France, F-R-A-N-T-Z. If you spell it wrong, you don't get your 5 free entries. So write it down correctly. F-R-A-N-T-Z at FanDuel.com. Promo code France. Void where prohibited. Coming right back after this short timeout. We'll get a bottom of the hour sports center. Hopefully get some of your phone calls in as well at 866-240-1065. Right here on the ticket.
Right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Indeed, the extravaganza rolls on right here on ESPN 106.5. The ticket, we are Toledo's sports leader. All right, phone lines are open at 866-240-1065. That's number one. Number two is I want to talk a little bit more about this MVP and about the decision that must be made by the writers, the voters, those who are deciding such things, these kings among men who decide for all of us what's more valuable than what is not. And I want to talk a little bit about our man, Oscar Robertson, the Big O. Big O, as you know, back in 1961, became the first player, and until now, the only player in NBA history to average a triple-double for an entire season. He averaged, in that season, Oscar Robertson averaged, where is his scoring average? His points were 30.8 points per game, his rebounds were 12.5, and his assists were 11.4. It's a spectacular thing to see. It really is. And the Big O, of course, has kind of been the gold standard of all-around players because of that all-around statistic. And when he averaged that, excuse me, in 61-62, and nobody did it for the next 40-plus years. How many years has it been since 61-62? 40 would be 2001, so what, 57 years?
Yep.
56 or 57 years, depending on how you look at it. When he did that, you know, like I said, and for so many years, his legend grew. He didn't do anything more. He didn't add to the totals, but it became much more impressive year by year as great all-around players like Jason Kidd, who had a lot of triple-doubles, couldn't do it. great all-around players like Magic Johnson, who had triple-doubles, couldn't do it. Great all-around players like LeBron James, who scores, rebounds, and assists. He couldn't do it. The more guys couldn't do it, whether they were quote-unquote trying to or not, I guess is a matter of opinion, but whether the more guys who couldn't do it, the more the legend of Oscar Robertson grew. That was just the greatest, most all-around season in NBA history. And now that it has been equaled in terms of, you know, the average of the triple-double, the numbers themselves aren't quite equal because Russell Westbrook just averaged barely over 10 in both categories of assists and rebounds, 10.4 and 10.5, I believe, whereas Oscar had 12 and 11, as I just quoted. Now that it has been equaled in terms of just doing it, it's got to be a lock, right? This has to be your MVP. Well, Oscar Robertson himself went to Oklahoma City for the Thunder's last game and gave a bit of a special recognition. They gave him the microphone, and he had a special call out for Russell Westbrook, talked about how special what he is doing is and what he has done is, talked about how great it is for the game, and then proceeded to lead the crowd in the chant of MVP. Which is just a remarkable thing for Oscar Robertson to acknowledge. You know, that's got to make you feel incredible if you're Russell Westbrook, which is great. But Russell Westbrook is not the MVP of this league, as far as I'm concerned. And I think Big O Oscar Robertson had something more in mind when he led the MVP fight for Russell Westbrook than just trying to help out Russell Westbrook. I think there might be something a little bit more personally involved there. And here's what I mean by this. Not too many people realize this. In 1961-62, that season in which the Big O averaged 30.8, 12.5, and 11.4, he did not even win the MVP. In 1961-62, the year that Oscar did that, Wilt Chamberlain happened to average 50 points per game, 50.4 points, and 25.7 rebounds per game.
I can't help but giggle every time I hear those numbers because they're just video game ridiculous.
So the Big O, of course, couldn't win the MVP with 30.8 and 12.5 and 11.4 because Wilt averaged 50.4 and 25.7, right? I mean, so Oscar didn't even win it. But guess what else? Neither did Wilt. Voila? Yeah, you're especially if you're a younger person who doesn't know this, a younger fan. Wilt didn't win it with 50 and 25 per game in 80 games? And Oscar didn't win it with a triple-double, a 30, 12, and 11? What the hell? The truth of the matter is Wilt Chamberlain finished second. Oscar Robertson finished third, both of them behind Bill Russell. Bill Russell got 51 first-place votes. Wilt Chamberlain only got 9. Oscar Robertson got 13. In other words, it wasn't even close. Bill Russell had got 297 MVP votes or points in the voting. Wilt 152, Oscar 135 combined. Russell that year averaged 18.9 points, a good 32 fewer than Chamberlain, and 23.6 rebounds, 2 fewer than Chamberlain, and 4.5 assists, 2 more than Chamberlain. But he was on a Celtics team that was part of the dynasty, that was a dynasty that won the NBA championship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he's the best player on the best team, and that's just kind of how the voting went. But here's my point. As Oscar Robertson's legend has grown since 61-62, having been the only player to ever average a triple-double, nobody else could do it, despite all of these great all-around players that have had kind of, you know, maybe an eye toward it or an opportunity or whatever, until Russell Westbrook. The fact that the Big O, his legend grew, people just assumed he was the MVP. He was not. Oscar Robertson, for all his greatness, did not win the MVP. And I believe that it's his belief, his contention, if you will, that if Russell Westbrook wins the MVP, it will show people exactly how valuable the triple-double should have been back in 61-62 when he was denied that award, that it will somehow enhance his own legacy, enhance his own reputation, put more of a positive spotlight on that designation as the only player to ever have done that until now. He didn't even come in second in the MVP voting. I don't think he wants to see another guy. Now there's only two in history who have ever done this. The average of a triple-double. He doesn't want to see a second guy get denied the MVP in the same historic season. Because A, it would be wrong for the new player, in this case Russell Westbrook, and B, I think it would diminish just a little bit in NBA history, for the sake of NBA history, exactly how impressive and important that statistic is. And he might be right, by the way. Think about it in these terms. If the only two players in NBA history to average a triple-double for the NBA season have a combined zero MVPs for it, essentially NBA history is saying, and the voice of the fan, if you will, you know, and that's what the writers are. They're the ones who bring us the stories of the games, those who vote, those who have votes, writers and broadcasters. They would essentially be saying that neither the media nor the fans really see that triple-double average as being all that damn special. It's only happened twice, neither one of y'all MVP. So therefore, it kind of diminishes what the Big O did and diminishes a little bit about what Russell Westbrook does. That's how it would be viewed. So I think the Big O has some ulterior motives there in trying to push Russell Westbrook for MVP to show that this statistic and this accomplishment does mean something. Now, having said all that, I don't think Russell Westbrook should be the MVP. That's not a diss of the Big O, but it is indeed the diss of the triple-double as a statistic that I think Big O fears that it would be. To me, I am disrespecting the triple-double as a statistic. And here's why, as I've said before. It is such an arbitrary thing to say if you average in double digits in three different categories, it's a better accomplishment than anything else anybody else can do. Who was more productive? Wilt Chamberlain with 50 and 25 or Oscar Robertson with 30, 12, and 11? You ask me, it's clearly Wilt Chamberlain. If you ask me, if you score 28 points in a game and grab 7 rebounds and hand out 6 assists, and somebody else scores 11 points in a game with 10 rebounds and 10 assists, the guy that scored 28 with 7 and 6 on the other side has had a far more productive game than the guy with 11 and 10. But one of them will get the credit of triple-double, cha-ching, add that one to his list. It's the 6th career triple-double for this person or that person. And it's like, wow. But he didn't have nearly as good a game as the guy who had 28, 7, and 6. He didn't get a triple-double, checkmark, cha-ching. He got nothing. Except more points. Scored more points, was more effective in putting points on the board for his team with his 28 and his 6 assists, depending on whether threes are involved. And if you want to eliminate them, I guess you can, just for the sake of the discussion. That's a combined 40 points that he accounted for. That's a combined 40 points. And with the 11 points and the 10 assists, the 11 points and the 10 assists, if you have 10 assists, that accounts for 20 points. Again, not counting threes into the equation. And your 11, that's 31 points. Who had the better game? Just on the points and assists. The guy who accounted for 40 or the guy who accounted for 31? And then again, with the rebounds being somewhat negligible in the difference between the two, what are we really talking about here? Now, for me, the MVP is going to be James Harden. I've waffled on this. I've gone back and forth. I've sat on the fence so long in the last month for this, I've got splinters in my ace. It's not a comfortable feeling. I'm off the fence now because the NBA season is officially closed. And if you ask me, the guy, and in this case it's James Harden, and I've given these numbers throughout the last few days as I kind of started to come off the fence, the guy that deserves this award, is the guy who had more big games and averaged more points for himself and his team through passing and through assists, who did so at a more efficient clip by being a better free throw shooter, better three-point shooter, better field goal shooter. That guy should be the MVP. If the stats are as close as they are, and they're this close, Westbrook and Harden are separated by 2 points per game.
That's plus Harden. Westbrook and Harden, or excuse me, plus Westbrook. 2 points plus Westbrook. They're separated, these two guys, by an assist and a half. That's plus Harden. And they're separated by two rebounds, 1.9 actually. That's plus Westbrook. So in other words, their stat lines are virtually identical. I am not going to just automatically default the trophy, the way so many are, to the guy whose one of his stats, the 1.9 plus, happens to be in rebounds and gives him the magical triple-double. My pick for James Harden is legit because I think Harden has done more with those points, rebounds, and assists in the fact that he has put up eight more victories. They're the third seed in the Western Conference as opposed to the sixth seed as the Oklahoma City Thunder are. That matters. And then, as I said before, I am just trying to make a point against the ridiculousness of arbitrary statistics. And the triple-double is an arbitrary statistic. Harden shot better from the floor, shot better from three, shot better at the free throw line, had 30 games of 60 points or more accounted for to 27 games for Westbrook, averaged 56 points per game accounted for to 55 for Westbrook, and Harden had eight more wins. You ask me? It's a neck-and-neck race. Harden wins by the length of a beard. Well, not his. a shorter beard than that.
Yes.
Kush, Frank, thoughts?
You know, I mean, I've been waffling on a lot of this, too. I mean, that's part of the gag of this whole thing. It doesn't feel, you know, even with the triple-double average, it doesn't feel, you know, clear-cut because of Harden, for example, what he's been able to do, and quite
it
frankly...
It doesn't feel that way to you, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Because
I think that's exactly what the right. I think Westbrook is going
like,
to
I keep
vote.
Comparing this...
Because to other people, it is clear-cut.
You know, it's funny. I keep comparing this in a way, and it still just doesn't feel right. Maybe there's an extra bias in the other one that's not here in this one, but I keep referring to... Every time I think of this conversation, especially on this part of it that you're talking about, the triple-double stat and how much weight that should really carry, it kind of reminds me... Back a couple years ago in the year Miguel Cabrera in baseball won the MVP award with the Triple Crown. But there was a legitimate debate. I was on the Miguel Cabrera side of it, but there was a legitimate debate all throughout that. Yeah, well, so what if he has the Triple Crown? It should go to Mike Trout. You remember that? That's kind of what I see developing here, which is also, by the way, regardless of my position on this, which I'm still leaning a little towards Harden, is why I think at the end of the day, when the award is announced, you'll see it be Westbrook. It'll play out very similarly, I think, in the votes.
It will play out for Westbrook, although I don't think it's for the same kind of reason. And before I explain myself, let me get Gargano's opinion on this. You agree? Is this similar to the triple crown, Miggy over Trout thing, or are they different in your opinion?
I think it's a little bit different. I think this race is a lot closer. I agree with Cushlin. I think the Miguel Cabrera Triple Crown was it. Like, done deal. In my opinion, Miguel Cabrera was the MVP. The more and more we look at this, you brought up a lot of great points, Bob. I'm still going to stick with Westbrook. I don't think the wins in the regular season, because, you know, who cares about the regular season now, right? I don't think they matter.
Both of those guys did. Both of those guys did.
And
I'm so
glad they
did. Neither one of them rested. Westbrook did at the very end, his 81st game, and then the second half of the 82nd game. But both of them played every game, and both of them wanted to win every game and played like their lives depended on it. So to me, I think the regular season does matter here in terms of win total. You put yourself in a position to be the 3 seed instead of the 6 seed, you give yourself a way better chance of advancing in the playoffs and getting toward the ultimate goal of a championship.
I totally agree. And with the stat lines being that close, I think that's why the whole averaging a triple-double in a season does come through, because some people need to look for a tiebreaker. And although you may not agree with that being the stat they should look at, I think that's why a lot of people are picking Westbrook.
See, and that's the interesting thing, the reason you say that, because to me, the tiebreaker should be the wins that you so casually dismissed. If you have two guys who played in the same conference, who played in the same against the same competition, and both of them played all the time, and both of them stayed healthy, and both of them were the leaders of their team by a lot. Both of them were the engines that drove their teams, and they finished with almost identical stat lines as they did. then the guy who led his team to the W more often than the L, that's got to be the tiebreaker,
and
not the arbitrary magical triple-double thing.
And that could play out, especially, and I think it will, for those who don't vote for Westbrook. I think that's going to be one of the things. And, you know, you referenced the 61-62, the year Oscar averaged the triple-double.
And finished third.
Finished third. A little bit, couple more background, quick facts that kind of almost set a precedent to what you're arguing. Because not only do we know, for example, you said it went to, you mentioned him and Wilt. Bill Russell won the MVP award. His numbers that year were 18.9 and 20 points, 23.6 rebounds a game. Decent numbers, especially on the rebounding. The other part of it, though,
but still two fewer than Wilt, as I pointed out, and 3 points less than him in scoring.
And here comes the other number. If wins is your tiebreaker, well, this explains it. That particular season, Boston won 60 and won the title. The Philadelphia Warriors, that's who they were back then, that yeah. Wilt played for, 49 wins. They lost to those Celtics in the East Finals. Oscar Robertson, I always love to have to throw this one out, playing for the Cincinnati Royals. You know him today as the Sacramento Kings. They were bounced in the semis 3-1 by the Pistons of all teams.
Yeah, so and that is what it came down to.
When it comes to wins and winning on this equation.
That is what it came down to there, clearly. And not to mention, here's the other part of this. And not too many people know this. The players voted then. Those were peers who decided the best player was Bill Russell because he was the best player on the best team. Not 50-point-per-game Wilt Chamberlain and 25-rebound-per-game and not 12-and-11 Oscar Robertson. The players made that decision, not the writers.
Yep.
So that's important to know. But here's one last thing before we get to the top of the hour Sports Center, and then we come back and talk about a number of other things, including spring football, because the Ohio State Scarlet and Gray game is coming up on Saturday. We're going to talk to Paul Keels about the Buckeyes in the spring. But here's the other thing, Jim, why I don't like your comparison to the Triple Crown story, the Miguel Cabrera versus Mike Trout battle. Here's the reason why. The triple-double thing, as I said before, is extraordinarily arbitrary because you don't have to be great in any one of those categories to be a triple-double guy.
True, you can have a Jason Kidd stat line, absolutely.
Right, you could be 14-10-10 or 14-11-10 or whatever the case might be. But the Triple Crown as opposed to the triple-double, and the reason why to me it carried so much more weight means that you led not just your team but the league in all of those important productive categories, in batting average, home runs, and RBIs. If I'm first in producing among everybody in the league in the consistency of getting hits department, which is the average, in the power department and the run production numbers, which is the home runs and the RBIs, I have done it all. Essentially, that's the game changer. That's the game ender. That's the closing discussion point. I led everybody in every category that mattered to hitters. I am the MVP if I win a triple crown. But that is far different than a triple double because you didn't even have to lead the league in anything to have a triple.
Good call. And in baseball with the triple crown, it's like the convergence of not only most valuable but best player.
Exactly.
If you're going to average those kind of numbers, which, again, as you correctly point out, lead the league. So, yeah, triple crowns on a different level. I'm just saying that's the only comparison I could think of to this MVP race a little bit is all I was saying.
And I understood what you're saying. I just wanted to point out that there really are very, very different things.
Very true.
They really, really are. And that's one of the reasons why the writers got it right when they gave it to triple crown winner Miguel Cabrera, and I think they'll get it wrong when they give it to triple double winner Russell Westbrook. All right, let's get a time out of here, top of the hour for SportsCenter. And on the other side of SportsCenter, we're going to talk a little college football in April. What? Yeah, spring game coming up. We're going to have it for you. As a matter of fact, there's a special program tonight. It's going to be the Scarlet and Gray spring game special tonight at 6 o'clock with Paul Keel. So we'll get a preview of that with the voice of the Buckeyes coming up next right here.
We chased the number one seed. We lost two games to Atlanta that, you know, we should have won. It's going to be a tough road, whether you're first seed, second seed, or third seed. You know, the Eastern Conference has gotten better. The most gratifying thing for me is just that, you know, we completed the season healthy. That we was able to come out of this long season with a lot of injuries, and we played through it, and our guys got through it, and now the playoffs are here, and we have all 15 guys healthy. So that's the most important thing to me and to this organization, to our team. With that being said, I feel very confident and comfortable that we got a good run in us. My confidence is that we can win. I know we can win the series. We just got to play Cavaliers basketball, which we're capable of doing, which we show we can do. So I know we have confidence to win, and we are going to win. So they've been playing well. And with Paul George, you know, coming off pin downs and trying to run LeBron around off catching shoots, we got to be prepared for that. Also with Teague being, you know, a fast guard who can get downhill and put a lot of pressure on you and get into the paint. Those are two things that, you know, we got to be better at. We got to be good at going into the playoffs.
I think there should be some concern there. They obviously didn't close out the season as they should have. I talked a little bit about the maturity of a championship team, the level that you need to be at. They aren't there. And they showed some weaknesses throughout the end of the season. However, it's the playoffs. They have the best player in the league in LeBron James. They got time to get it back going. I mean, they'll have a tough first-round series against Indiana. This team is not going away easy.
I'd be lying if I didn't say there's reason for concern. Sure. I mean, we had a very rocky, adverse regular season. In many ways, that's a real blessing for us because it's how we like it. This team is much more comfortable with its back against the wall and when everybody says we can't.
Well, that was our season, wasn't it? I mean, always down early. Our starters never get us, or very rarely get us off to a good start. Come back, which we do most of the time. Bad shooting team. And you pretty much, in one game, saw us for what we were this year.
This part of the season, it's always been that way. I mean, you look at the good teams, with, you said, the big three resting and some of these other really good teams. Of course they're resting. They don't care about being in that second spot. They care about being healthy. Now you talk about some of these bad teams that are resting. That's nothing that's changed either. I mean, you talk about with the Nets, they know what Jeremy Lin can give them. They know what their good players can give them. You got guys that have been practicing all season long, looking for an opportunity to play. Well, here's their chance to play.
At Ohio State, like a handful of the programs in America, careers are made, legends are born here. Year six, kind of change the paint on the building a little bit. It's been all positive so far.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward we roll into hour number two after that comprehensive montage of sports sounds. We will get back to the NBA discussion as the playoffs get underway on Saturday, but something else is happening on Saturday. It's not the playoffs. In fact, it's the opposite. Rather than the end of the season, it's the beginning of the season. The beginning of the beginning of the beginning of the season. It's spring football. And for Ohio State fans, that means the Scarlet and Gray game. It will be coming up this Saturday. We will have it for you live right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, 12:30 on Saturday. And there's a spring game special tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. that we'll carry as well on the Ohio State Radio Network, and that will be hosted by none other than the voice of the Buckeyes, Mr. Paul Keels, who joins us for a little preview. Hey, Paul, how are you?
Good, Bob. How you doing?
I am outstanding. Hope you're having a good spring, and hope the Buckeyes are having a good spring. And I guess that's where we want to dive right in, Paul, and talk a little bit about some of the new faces that we can kind of expect to see, some of the younger players that were in reserve roles that are trying to win starting spots, which, of course, starts here in the springtime. And I guess the first question I'm going to ask you about is, how are the Buckeyes going to replace Curtis Samuel? Who are some of the top prospects that we might want to keep our eyes on in the spring game tomorrow? Or, excuse me, Saturday.
Well, I think you look at Curtis Samuel and certainly trying to replace him, Bob, both as a runner and a receiver, as an H-back. It sounds right now from what we're hearing, and again, remember, practices are closed, so we don't get a chance to eyeball it, but It sounds like Paris Campbell has kind of been the guy that has jumped into that H-back spot. You know, he was a running back in high school. He's really shown his worth as a receiver, but he's a guy right now that, from what we're hearing the coaches say, he's kind of got the H-back spot at the moment, but you know, the running back spot, I think you look at Mike Weber, Demario McCall, who in some small doses showed what he could do last year. And a youngster by the name of J.K. Dobbins apparently has shown that he's got the ability to where he's going to play this fall. How much, we don't know. But those are the guys. And then I think dovetailing off that, you know, certainly there's a lot of question about the wide receiver position and seeing guys kind of move forward, because you can certainly look at part of where the offensive difficulties occurred last year. And it was at times where there just wasn't that deep threat, and certainly guys like K.J. Hill, Terry McLaurin. Another new name is Benjamin Victor, who, you know, we got a little bit of glimpse at him late in the season last year. That, you know, hopefully those are guys, along with, the you know, Paris Campbell, can help fill that bill that Curtis Samuel gave Ohio State last year.
Paul, let's talk about the quarterback position. You know, 2 years ago, interestingly enough, I think everybody agreed that had he not gotten hurt prior to the national championship run, as we know, JT Barrett probably would have been on the stage as one of the Heisman finalists. Last year, going into the season, a lot of people had him on the preseason Heisman list, a watch list, as a guy who might be there again. And then the season didn't go the way that maybe, especially end the way that JT would have hoped that it did. And now this year I'm looking at Heisman favorites, and we're seeing Sam Darnold out at USC as being one of the top names, and I'm not seeing JT Barrett on too many lists. So I guess it kind of begs the question, what can we expect from a guy who is a two-time Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year, a former Heisman, you know, a finalist, or at least talked about as such, to, you know, coming back for his final year of eligibility?
Hopefully, Bob, what we'll see is a guy to take advantage of all the experience that he's gleaned in his time here. And there's no question, the year did not go last year like many thought it would be for JT Barrett, given the fact that there was no question who the quarterback was. And yeah, we saw some of the doses of what we had seen in 2014, but not consistently. And, you know, not the deep ball that we saw when he had Devin Smith and Evan Spencer to get the ball to, or even Michael Thomas for that matter. Certainly some of the difficulty that the offensive line had at times probably limited what JT Barrett can do running the football. So hopefully what we're going to see is a guy going into his final year of eligibility that really will accept the challenge of trying to improve his part of the game as part of the offense. And I think the other part that's going to be fun to watch is the addition of Kevin Wilson as offensive coordinator and working with JT Barrett and working with this offense in total, as well as Ryan Day, the new quarterback's coach, and see what kind of influence that has on JT Barrett. Because all we have to do is think back to 2014 before his injury, and really the end of 2015 when he reclaimed the starting job, all of the things that JT Barrett does bring to the game.
You know, it is very interesting. That experience, you would think, certainly would be and should be a great thing for him going forward. In fact, is there anybody in the country coming back who's got the kind of experience that JT Barrett has had? Not just, you know, in terms of number of years as a starter, but obviously postseason play, you know, in terms of making the playoffs a couple of times, even though he didn't play in the Cardale run. But he was a part of that team that did. And then, of course, last year making it there as well. So those kinds of experiences in the biggest moments probably should have him prepared more than anybody else. Does any of that rub off, Paul Keels, on the other Buckeyes? You know, from a quarterback with experience and poise and guys, just follow my lead. I've been down many, many, many roads already before.
You would hope so, Bob. And I think especially some of the other experienced players, when you think about, you know, Billy Price, who's going to duplicate what Pat Elflein did, moving from guard to center, with guys like Paris Campbell and Terry McLaurin and, you know, and hopefully Marcus Ball and A.J. Alexander at tight end. Those are guys that really can kind of see the benefit of that opportunity. But also hopefully what we'll see, too, is, you know, not just J.T. Barrett, but that whole offensive group working together to realize, you know, they've got to step their game up. It was an offense that underperformed in so many ways last year because of what we thought they could do. We, you know, we saw some of what Mike Weber could show. You know, a young man as a redshirt freshman who hit 1,000 and could really be a guy that could have an impact at times during the course of the game. But, you know, we're hearing great things about Luke Farrell and A.J. Alexander at tight end. You know, can that be another part of this offense? You know, we've heard references from some of the players referring to Kevin Wilson as the mad scientist with some of the different things they're going to do on offense. And, you know, if you think about what Kevin did with his offenses at Indiana and the headaches they gave Ohio State, you know, hopefully that is something that translates into all of this, and that, you know, guys, because of the Barrett experience that we talked about, can also add their own piece to all of that picture to make it, you know, because let's face it, what really had people feeling bad about the way the season ended last year was getting shut out. Not that they lost the game to Clemson, but that they couldn't manage a single point. And certainly you got to hope that motivates that offensive group.
Paul Keels joining us for a little preview of the spring game, the Scarlet and Gray game, which is coming up on Saturday at 12:30. We'll have it on the Ohio State Radio Network right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. You know, the quarterbacks in that game, obviously it's not really for JT. He's the starter. The guys who are, you know, going to be looking to impress the coaches, of course, are going to be guys like Joe Burrow and Dwayne Haskins and maybe Tate Martell. What do you, and I know you, like, as you pointed out, that the practices are closed. But just based on what you hear and the people that you talk to, who has the leg up in that derby to be right next in line behind JT?
Well, from the sound of everything, it still is Joe Burrow, who was number two last year and really got very few opportunities to play. But, you know, he's the next most experienced player. Dwayne Haskins is the interesting one because he spent the time as a redshirt and Urban Meyer during the course of the year last year. And even at times this spring has said this is a kid that one day has the potential to be an outstanding football player at Ohio State. And, you know, Tate Martell certainly gets people's attention because of all of the hoopla being recruited. But, you know, it's just, I believe a week ago, Bob, that they did say that it's Joe Burrow. But, you know, the coach has talked about how Dwayne Haskins has made great strides. Now, you don't know if that's coach speak and it's dangling the carrot a little bit, but there certainly doesn't seem to be a lack of talent to develop there at the position behind J.T. Barrett.
You know, you mentioned Weber obviously as being, you know, the feature back, if you will, because he got 1,000 last year and could only get better this year. But a guy like DeMarre McCall, you mentioned his name too. He's a true sophomore, correct? As opposed to Weber, who's a redshirt sophomore. So he's got feature back capability as well. If he isn't the guy getting the ball 20 times the way a Weber is or close to it, how will they use McCall?
Well, I think there had been some thought that he might be a candidate to be an H-back, and maybe that still might happen before summer practice gets here. Our understanding, that hasn't happened in the spring at this point in time. But certainly, I think we've seen over the course of years that, you know, as Archie Griffin used to put it, you've got to have a pair and a spare. So, you know, for the durability that we've seen running backs at Ohio State have, when you think about Hyde and Elliott, certainly it helps when you've got a change of pace guy. And DeMarre McCall really, you know, I think in maybe just a couple of lopsided games when he was able to get in the end zone once by run, once by catch, certainly has shown the open field ability to do some things. And, you know, he was a little smaller. Hopefully what he's done is build up some of his strength a little bit and his size a little bit. But, you know, this is a guy that there is an opportunity there, although we're hearing a lot of good things about J.K. Dobbins, a freshman who enrolled early. Matter of fact, there's been a lot of talk about how this whole early enrollee group has really shown well. But, you know, what you hope happens at the tailback position, like so many others, is that there's competition in practice, and that pushes the incumbents to get better and makes the backups feel like there's an opportunity for them.
Just a moment or two more with Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes. You're going to hear him later on, by the way, on the Ohio State Radio Network at about 6 o'clock, right here after drive time with a preview of the Scarlet and Gray game. But Jim Cushlin has a question for you, Paul.
And looking at, we cover quarterback and we're covering tailback, but obviously players leaving / graduating, it's going to open up holes in other positions too. Outside of the two we've mentioned, Paul, what would you see as the position group that's going to need the most new guys replacing guys that are gone? And give us any insight you might have as to who some of those names might be.
Well, we mentioned some of them, Jim, at the receiver group, and that's going to be an interesting one to watch. Certainly, the cornerback position, when you lose Kerryon Conley and Marshawn Lattimore, that's going to be big. And Denzel Ward, who was the third corner and played an awful lot, in some cases played more than the guys that left last year. He and Damon Arnett are guys that certainly are going to figure in there. We're hearing good things about Kendall Sheffield, who's a JC kid, has come in with some experience. And Jeffrey Okuda is a young man that they really feel is going to help. You know, the big shoes to fill with what Malik Hooker gave them in the secondary. But Damon Webb is a guy that has been an experienced player there. And the other part, Jim, is going to be the linebacking group, because it'll have a different configuration. Chris Werling moves from outside to middle linebacker. We certainly saw what Jerome Baker could do. And Dante Booker comes back after playing only in, I believe, two series last year. So, you know, those are going to be, at least on the defensive side, those are going to be kind of the groups to watch to see, you know, some names that are somewhat familiar, some new names, especially with the cornerbacks, to see where some of those people fit into the mix.
What about the right side of the offensive line?
That's still a question right now from what we understand. And, you know, Billy Price moves from guard to center, but, you know, certainly you're looking at Michael Jordan, Demetrius Knox, Brandon Bowen's name, and Matthew Burrell has been talked about a lot, Jamarco Jones. I think that right guard is the one that they're still kind of waiting to see if somebody can grab a hold of that. Josh Allaby has moved from defensive line to offensive line. Haven't heard how he figures into all of that. And another name to remember, too, Malcolm Pridgett, who was a junior college transfer. He got hurt before the season started last year. He's a guy that they were talking about last year that he might have gained some reps. So, but that right side still has got a little bit of a question there.
Paul Keel's joining us with a little preview of the spring game. There's going to be a more extensive preview. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's on tap for tonight in the spring game specials that we'll be airing from 6 to 7?
Well, we'll get the wisdom of Jim Lachey, which is always a great thing to have. But we're going to hear from Kerry Combs, the cornerbacks coach, and he's also in charge of the special teams. He's going to talk about what's gone on in the spring, you know, trying to get those corners up to speed. And Kerry also oversees a lot of the special teams players and the guys he calls the Sharks. So we'll get a chance to hear from Kerry about that. And then also, it's my understanding, we're hoping that Kevin Wilson, the new offensive coordinator, will spend some time with us talking about what's going on there. And we mentioned it earlier, Bob and Jim, Kevin, you know, great offensive mind when you think about his time at Miami, Ohio as an assistant, at Northwestern as an assistant, at Oklahoma as an assistant, and as a head coach at Indiana. And for Urban Meyer and Ohio State to get him was really a good get for what he potentially can bring this coaching staff as far as his offensive gray matter.
Terrific stuff, as always, Paul. We'll look forward to the special tonight at 6, and then, of course, the broadcast of the spring game on Saturday. Looking forward to hearing you on the Ohio State Radio Network. And thanks for squeezing in a few minutes for us this afternoon, Paul.
My pleasure, guys. Take care.
Always a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you, Paul. Paul Keel's joining us. He is the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, of course, on the Ohio State Radio Network and springtime football. You know, a lot of people don't like this. A lot of people. Not every school, by the way, has a spring game. Not every D1 school has a spring game. They just feel like it's too much potential for injury if guys are going at one another. It's one thing to have them practice against one another in the spring, have them work, evaluated by coaches as they fight for jobs and positions on the depth chart. You get them in live competition against one another in a spring game, it can get a little bit chippy. It can get a little bit rough. You know, guys really think, you know, guy really thinks he has a chance to move up and unseat somebody from their spot on the depth chart. And it gets nasty. So the Buckeyes, of course, have it. It is a tradition. It'll draw. I mean, geez, they won't draw 110,000 down there to the horseshoe.
But it'll
gym,
still but make your jaw drop how much they will.
That's
get.
What I was going to say. But it's going to be a ton. I mean, you know. Yep. I mean, do you remember what it is in an average year? Don't they get some 60,000-70,000?
Yeah. I 50 would not surprise
50?
Me.
50?
Okay. At least 50 would not surprise me. Same with Michigan, who's also on Saturday, the Wolverine spring game at the Big House. Our sister station 93 Nash Icon will have that one by the by at 12:45 broadcast time. So they'll get the same probably number.
Yeah, which is just really
and I'm triple checking for the dates on this because yeah. I'm pretty sure because you're right, not every D1 school has it, but I'm pretty sure the Rockets and the Falcons do. They usually do.
Okay. I know they do. I know they do because we've talked about them in the past and we've gotten those dates and in fact we'll give those out again as well. But I know that not all because I have a couple of friends whose kids play Division I football and they don't have spring games at their schools. I won't mention which ones they are, but it surprised me to find that out. I didn't realize and I asked why and they were the ones who told me is the coaches just don't feel like the risk is worth the reward there. You're not going to see a ton more than you are already seeing in practice and in practice you have control and you stop a drill immediately if something starts to get a little bit too rough and if you're into a game type atmosphere where you're bringing fans and referees and everything else and they're treating it like a game, it's just the risk is too much for some. It's just a different coach's, some different coach's opinions. Okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to hook you up with another opportunity here before we hit the bottom of the hour Sports Center coming your way with another opportunity to fly away to sunny Florida. If you would like to be a qualifier for the ESPN 106.5 The Ticket Orlando Flyaway, you and a guest could spend 4 days and 3 nights in Orlando. All you've got to do right now is listen each and every day from 3 to 5 on this program, and we will qualify one person per day when I tell you to call. Or you can also go on our website, which is 1065theticket.com, and you can qualify there once per day as well. Caller number 5 to 866-240-1065. The next qualifier will be you. Brought to you by the beautiful Orlando Center Marriott. Offer a world of possibilities. Allegiant Air, Shays Carpet, Toledo Express Airport, Premier Vapor, Country Heart, and your friends here at Toledo's ESPN 106.5 The Tickets. Good luck. Call the number 5 that is yours. Beyond the contest, you can also dial that same number, 866-240-1065, to get in and talk with us as we get into the NBA playoffs coming up next right here on The Ticket.
Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
All right, rolling on right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. Shocking news, the passing of Steelers owner and chairman Dan Rooney. Absolutely shocking. Apparently just came down about 30 minutes ago or so from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette confirming all of this. And it's picked up by the rest of the media as well. Age 84, Dan Rooney succeeded his father as Steelers team president. And rose to become one of the most powerful and beloved owners in sports. I think all of that is very, very true and easy to say. He oversaw 4 of the Steelers' Super Bowl championships for the team that his family founded so many decades ago. Dan Rooney became more than just that owner, though. He was a huge, huge influence on the National Football League. He was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2000 as team president, just the second father and son combination in the Football Hall of Fame to be enshrined, along with his father, Art Sr., who founded the franchise. Under his leadership in the late 60s, the Steelers transformed from lovable losers into Super Bowl dynasty in the 70s, remain among the most successful and popular franchises in the game today. But more than that, the powerful voice that he was, he is the man for whom the Rooney Rule is named. Rooney Rule, of course, a concerted effort to get more minorities opportunities to achieve the highest rankings in the National Football League, from head coaches to coordinators to front office positions, including general management, player personnel directors, maybe even ownership, all of those things, all kind of opening a lot of doors for a lot of people, including the black head coach of the Steelers, Mike Tomlin, who was given an interview shortly after the Rooney Rule went into effect, and did so well that he got the job. It was widely expected that the Steelers were going to give the job to one of their two assistants, prime head coaching candidate assistants, Russ Grimm or Ken Whisenhunt at the time. And in comes Mike Tomlin under the rules of the Rooney Rule that require the interviewing of a certain number of minorities for various important positions. And Mike Tomlin made the most of it, blew them away, and got hired, and is now a two-time Super Bowl coach and one-time Super Bowl champion. So the Dan Rooney era has really touched a lot of people in a lot of ways.
Yep.
In the National Football
League. Down to even someone like me in this regard, even after everything you just said, for Dan Rooney specifically, the biggest thing that I will always, as a Browns fan, have a tip of the cap for, he was the one owner who voted against Art Modell moving the Browns, if you recall.
That's a great point.
For me as a Browns fan, Dan Rooney earned my everlasting respect for that and nothing else.
That is a very, very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. I kind of forgot that about him. And, of course, tributes are pouring in all over the place right now by way of social media and regular media. Former coach Bill Cowher, he was like a father, a friend, a mentor, a boss who inspired others around him, a people person who never forgot where he came from. He epitomized Pittsburgh, hardworking, humble, no-nonsense, tell it the way it is, and never forget where he came from. That's him, and that's Pittsburgh. Steelers general manager Kevin Colbert, you could speak all day and never encompass what he means, not only to the Steelers, but to this game. I think it's his sincere interest in people, first and foremost, and his ability to treat everybody fairly, but also encompassing a great understanding of our game, and in particular, the Pittsburgh Steelers. And former world-class, all-pro, Hall of Fame defensive lineman Mean Joe Green said Dan has always led with humility. When things go as planned, Dan is in the background. When things don't go as planned, he's in the forefront, and that's what his job was. Wow, very well said. So very, very sad loss for the game of football, for the NFL, for obviously the other owners, and certainly for all of the fans of the Pittsburgh Steelers who knew and loved Dan Rooney, and certainly the Dan Rooney family, or the Art Rooney Sr. family, whose tradition carries on. So sad, sad news there from the National Football League. All right, I want to get back into some of the more current news. Now, Jim Cushlin, I want to talk a little bit about the National Basketball Association playoffs. We know where the matchups are now.
Right.
We know what the matchups now, I guess I should say.
Indeed.
The Pistons, of course, are not part of this equation. Last year, they were the 8th seed. They got swept by the Cavaliers, the 1 seed. You, among others, predicted that those Pistons would take a step further this year and not just be an 8th seed, but perhaps climb as high as a 6, 5, or maybe even a 4 seed and get a home court for the first round of the playoffs. As it happens, not so much. They did not make the playoffs. They had a miserable season that started and ended in misery, quite frankly. Started with injuries and ended with question marks. And Stan Van Gundy's got an awful lot of work to do to rebuild this thing. Make no mistake about that for next year. We'll have a retrospective of that tomorrow with Aaron McMahon, who covers the Detroit Pistons, and we'll look forward to that. The other team we cover is the world champion, defending as they might be, and I say that very carefully because they might be defending their championship. They haven't defended anybody, at least for the last 2 or 3 months. One of the worst defenses in the league. But the Cavaliers are still the in-name-only defending champions, and they're going to open up with the Indiana Pacers. Now, before we make predictions on various NBA first-round matchups and how we think these are going to go, you said you've got something interesting. You've got some numbers, some analytics. Are these analytics? Are these sabermetrics? What do you have for us to try to process this series?
For me, it's not really analytics or numbers. It's more of a vibe I'm getting, and it comes from the way the Cavs have played.
So you have a crystal ball then?
Yeah, kind of.
Instead of analytics in a computer, I've got I saw it in the stars.
Yeah,
it's in the air.
I'm going that route because for me, I do think the Cavs win this series. For me, it's either going to be an arduous 6-game affair or it's going to be a sweep. I honestly don't think there's any middle ground.
You figured that out all by yourself, huh? They're either going to beat him in a sweep or they're going to beat him in a lot of games.
Well, there's a difference, though. I mean, I don't think any – the way this team is playing, it's hard to envision them sweeping anybody, right? But they could very easily go out, win the first couple games over this weekend, and I think game two is Monday, be up 2-0. And in a sense, it would turn into a lot like what last year's Pistons first-round series for the Cavs was. It was a sweep, and it felt like a sweep in name only because that was actually a tough four games.
Some close games,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it could go down that route. But given the way they've been playing, all the issues that I think stem from the resting, which is clearly a lot of these guys are just not on the same page. That's completely reflected in their excuse that is defense. And so you could have a back-and-forth, nail-biting kind of six-game affair, of which there's two options. It's either going to play out similar to how the Raptors East Finals. Remember, Cavs went up 2-0, everything looked fine, and suddenly Bismack Biyombo shows up, and you're like, and we're leaving Canada. It's like, why is this 2-2? And then they roll.
Has anybody ever seen Bismack Biyombo since then?
I know I saw him here and there in Charlotte, but he was not averaging double digits in points or rebounds. And then they came back to Cleveland for Game 5 last year against Toronto, and they more or less blew him out. Or it's going to be, and this I think is much more likely, and this is where I'm leaning in terms of what my pick for this series. Those are my other two options of how it could play out for the sweep and the six. The other way it goes six is think that East semis 2 years ago, Cavs Bulls. You know, it was right after Kevin Love gets his arm pulled out of his socket, so they're trying to recalibrate the line. Remember, they started Mike Miller in game one. That's yep. part of the reason they lost that game. And it took them four games and a game winner to even that series up at two. And then they proceeded to blow them out in the next two once they finally righted themselves. And I think that's more likely because the similar dynamic of right now, we know they're not playing well. They don't seem to be on the same page. The defense is awful. They're kind of a mess, which is kind of how they felt going in to that Bulls series in the semis 2 years ago. And as such, they dropped the first one with no Kevin Love and Mike Miller starting. They went down 2-1 because convenient banking hours were open for Derrick Rose. And then they needed the game winner. Otherwise, they would have been down 3-1. And that's kind of where I think this series is going to go. I still think the Cavs are the superior team and should win. But I think everything we've seen, because since the All-Star break, if not longer, that's a pretty big enough sample size that this team is a mess. And I, quite frankly, even with the proverbial that they keep talking about, we're going to flip that switch and everything will be fine, yeah, it's going to scuffle for a few games. Do not be surprised if the Cavs early in this series might be down 2-1 after, say, a Game 3 split in Cleveland-Indiana wins. Or at least don't be surprised if this is 2-2 coming back to Cleveland.
Well, Jim, not to undo all of the analysis you just did, but I am going to undo all of the analysis you did without all the analysis to counter it.
Okay.
Mine is just more of a hunch thing.
Okay.
I think it's going to be in between what you said. It's not going to be a sweep or an arduous six or a seven game journey. It's going to be the Cavaliers in five. I think everything that you said is true about the way they played since the All-Star break and the second half and what they end up finishing 23-22 in their last 45 games.
Yeah, it's basically 500, which for this roster is unacceptable.
It is unacceptable, and the defense is unacceptable. And I'm looking more at the opponent here, and I'm not seeing a team that is extraordinarily dangerous. Paul George is a great, great player, but he's not, you know, one of the top five players in the league. Quite frankly, he hasn't had as dynamic and a superstar of a kind of year as we have seen him be capable of in the past.
Now, I'll say this. They certainly got the right matchup. You think they Chicago, did. Miami, or Indiana. If you're a Cavs fan, Indiana's name you wanted was Indiana.
No question about that. No question about that. I didn't want any part of Jimmy Butler in the way they have done the Cavaliers this year. And Miami, of course, just seems to have their number as well. So to me, yes, they got the right matchup here. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's going to be the Cavaliers in five. They haven't been able to piece together all of their new pieces that were supposed to come in and kind of strengthen them, like Jeff Teague from the Hawks. You know, just hasn't really all fit together in a nice, cohesive way for whatever reason. It just looks a little stilted, disjointed in Indianapolis. So for me, I think the Cavaliers win, and they win it in five. They'll probably lose in the traditional pattern of favorites at home. They'll win their first two at home. They'll go there and lose one to an excited, enthusiastic Indianapolis crowd in game three. And then they'll come back and win in games four and five. So I think it'll be the Cavaliers in five. And
if it
I don't think they're going to be threatened that much until they get to the next round.
And here's my question. Yeah, and that kind of leads to this obvious question. Whether it's a sweep or five, assuming it's not an arduous six or seven, if it's either the my sweep scenario or your call of five, then what are we saying about this team at that point? Are we in, let me wait till we see what they look like in the next round, or will five playoff games, depending how they go, be enough to say, okay,
the
now
former,
this team looks right?
The former,
okay,
not the latter.
Fair enough.
Because to me, it's not going to be about really what they are. It's going to be more about the opponent and the matchup. It's the right matchup. That doesn't mean they will be the right matchup when they face Washington, if it's Washington, or Atlanta, if it's Atlanta, or whatever the case might
be. The bracket will spit out the Toronto-Milwaukee winner for round two, a Boston or a Washington, given how the bracket for an NBA playoff works. You only see one of them in the East Finals,
and of course, I'm not assuming chalk victories here.
I am.
Because you know things. If things go according to seed, obviously the way you pointed it out, certainly will be the case.
Honestly, I am for one in the East and I'll get to who's not in a bit.
I don't want to use the word fear when I say I fear the Wizards and I fear the Celtics, but what I mean is, I am a lot less comfortable when those series start, that if it comes down to them. Less so Toronto, by the way, just to be clear about that. Less so Toronto.
They mashed Wizards up Toronto when they tried this year.
Say again?
They mashed Toronto in the three games when the Cavs were kind of trying.
Exactly. So they don't bother me as much as the other two do. So to answer your question about what would we know about a five-game Cavaliers win or a series win over the Pacers, my answer would be not a whole lot.
Okay.
I need to see more. I need to see, even against Toronto, I need to see them for, you know, a few games against one of those two teams that I just mentioned to tell you whether or not I'd feel really confident that they still have a chance to defend their championship.
And you're not wrong in that opinion. You're really not, because, again, this is probably the right matchup from a Cavs perspective. So you're right. Maybe winning in four or five won't show you as much. Let me see what they do against Toronto. But definitely, you got to see something. You got to see whatever the malaise and whatever the heck was wrong with them mentally. Because it was more just that, and the resting and the injuries. There was an that was just emanating off this team the last month and a half to boot.
It was an ugh.
Yeah.
It was a.
Now that will
be. I mean, honest to God, it was puke inducing.
Yeah.
When I watched,
absolutely,
especially defensively for the better part of the last month.
I will say that factor is something we will be able to gauge out of this series against Indiana if they've really, you know, fixed that.
Yeah, and we'll get some sense of it, but obviously not the full package. Frank Argano, what do you think? Are you into the six or seven arduous games thing, the sweep thing, or with me kind of right in the middle of it?
When you guys were talking about this, the first thing that came to my mind was the scene in Miracle where Herb Brooks says, "You guys don't have enough talent to win on talent alone." Well, in this case, it's the other way around. The Cavs definitely have enough talent to win on talent alone. I think this series is just going to be a sweep.
All right, that's fair enough. That very, very well could be the case, that they don't lose that third game. I just kind of, unless I see a team that truly is not only talented on talent alone, as you say, but also playing well, I'm not going to predict a sweep. Until I see that, I'm going to predict at least one game going the other way. All right, real quick on this, Jim, because we don't have a ton of time left. But you also had a theory on how we can somehow deal with the issue of players resting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a fight all season long. I have done at least two shows in which I went pretty much wall to wall, start to finish, bitching about this.
Really? Only two?
Yeah, well, yeah, two full shows. I have brought it up on multiple shows, but I spent two almost full shows on this on back-to-back days because I was just so livid. It was right around the time the Cavaliers did this in L.A. They sat everybody against the Clippers, and then they were playing in the same building. So it wasn't like you had to travel to another city. They were in the same building against the Lakers the next night, and they played everybody against them instead. It's just embarrassing, not just the Cavaliers with their guys resting, but the whole nine yards with the stars in the league now. Kind of embracing this. I don't want to play 82 games.
Yeah.
I don't care what my contract says. I'm going to play as few as I can possibly play and still get paid. But you've got a theory on the resting issue?
Now, my theory on the resting issue goes back to something that along the lines of this resting conversation, which feels like endless, and that's the biggest reason, honest to goodness, Bob, that I'm glad the playoffs are here, because hopefully this conversation, for all of our mental sake, can be tabled for a while, you know? But one of the comments you always hear kind of as a follow-up, as a tag to it, especially from players, is they like the season shortened. Now, we all know in the sad, practical, real world that it won't happen because, you know, cha-ching, money. It won't. That's why it won't get reduced. But say you got to a part where they got rid of the Spaceballs 2, the search for more money, mental aspect to all this, and they were open to reducing the schedule. There's really, I've been looking at it. There's only two ways that it could function properly. One is a 72-game schedule. The other is 58. Now, how did I come up with those two numbers? Start with 58. There's 30 teams in the league, right? So whether you're the Cavs or the Pistons, you know, listeners, if you're a Cavs fan, Pistons fan, use Cavs or Pistons as the example. So there's 30 teams. Take your team out. That's 29 left. 29 times 2 is 58. That would play one game against everybody in your building.
You're chopping 24 games off of the schedule.
This is actually what I'd really like to do. If the players
overall... Are you crazy? They're not going to be willing to give up 2 games of revenue, let alone 24 games.
And that's why if you ever see the schedule reduced, number 2 is probably where it's going to be. Chopping 10 games off for 72. And the 72 comes in, you start with the 58, and then everybody in your conference, so in the Cavs Pistons case, the East, that's 14 more opponents you play one more time. Because, you know, some Eastern Conference teams, you're the Cavs Pistons, you play 3 times. Your division and a few others, you play 4. You're chopping those 10 games off. And that'll help for playoff tiebreakers because you only have to go to 1 head-to-head.
But it's not going to matter, though, Jimmy. This is the problem with the theory of reducing it at all. At the end of the day, it comes back to if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. They're still going to rest. They'll say 70. They'll say 72 is just too much. You still have this. We still have that. And I still want my rest. I'm going to take 6 games off, and I'll play 66 instead of 72. The same way they are now.
No, you're right.
If you give them a shorter schedule, it will not alleviate some guys just saying, I need a rest day, and you're still going to have these problems. And I
agree, and that's why the real thing you have to do is they have to figure out during this offseason some way to legitimately punish teams who are clearly abusing it, like the Cavs.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Without, of course, you know, I shouldn't say without, I guess, while finding a way to answer the question of fake injuries. The knee is sore today. When really it's a rest day,
right,
but I've got them
good
on the
call.
And you know what the answer is to me? You make them go on a disabled list, a baseball style disabled list.
We did play
if you're
a clip last
miss,
week on
if
that.
The guy's going to miss for a sore knee. He's on a 10-day DL, and you've got to give him 10 games off or 10 days off. And let's see if you're willing to do that. That's something we can talk about tomorrow because the music is playing right now. Drive Time coming up next right here with Mr. Miller. Stay where you are. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon at 3 for Free for All Friday.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.